Kingston Health Sciences Center is setting new benchmarks in brain tumor care with its Integrative Brain Tumor Program. Kingston Health Sciences Center detailed the program's successful start in a release last week, including dramatic improvements in care, global interest, and the announcement of new funding from the Canadian Cancer Society amounting to $150,000 per year for the next 3 years. Developed under the leadership of Dr. Teresa Persner, a neurosurgeon, researcher, and entrepreneur, this innovative program is achieving best-in-class patient outcomes through a unique blend of academic and entrepreneurial thinking. Dr. Persner shared the program's beginnings and the philosophy behind it in an interview with CFRC. I was wondering if you'd like to just discuss some of the specific differences in the approach of this program compared to how things used to be done that have led to significant improvements in patient outcomes at KHSC.
Yeah, for sure. So I think a big difference with what we did versus traditional academic approaches to problem solving is that we really took more of an entrepreneurial approach. And so the problem that I face, I'm fairly new to Queen's still, so I got here about 3 years ago. And when I came here, I discovered pretty early on that our patients with brain tumors, they were receiving good operations and they were recovering well from the operations, but they were having a tremendously difficult time efficiently navigating the healthcare system afterwards. So I think it's something that most people can relate to in the Canadian healthcare system. It's not always so easy to go from point one to point two. And often things get dropped and lost between you know, important visits and things like that. So I sort of dug into, you know, why is this happening? Is there one specific pain point that's driving all these delays to care? And when I looked into it, there wasn't really one problem. It's just that the entire system was inefficient. And so people with brain tumors, they have to go through quite a few steps, about 16 different steps within the first 2 weeks of their diagnosis. Things like getting CAT scans and MRIs and consultations and surgery and referrals. So they have to get through all of these things, and they were getting small delays at every step. So there wasn't one step that was a huge delay. Every step had small delays. And so cumulatively, it became just a very sluggish system. So when I thought about, you know, how do we solve this? I kind of thought back at, you know, who solves problems, these systemic problems well? And what I'll say is I've spent a lot of time in academia, but also in the entrepreneurial world. And academia is very, very good at identifying and describing problems. So academic approaches are really good at saying, here is the problem, here is a source of inequity, and here are the people suffering from it. Academia is not especially good at then solving that problem. It kind of, the buck ends kind of at finding, discovering, and describing. Whereas in my experience, entrepreneurship or small startups are unbelievably good at identifying specifically what the customer needs, rapidly developing prototypes to meet those needs, and then iterating based on how well their prototypes reflect the needs of the customer. And if a startup can't do that well and meaningfully, it won't survive its first year, right? So it has to survive. It has to be lean, fast, and actually focused on what do people want from me. And so of the two systems, I thought, well, what if we combine them? We'll use the academic approaches to identify the specific problems. But then we can use an entrepreneurial approach to then rapidly solve those problems. And so long story short, the approach we took is an approach called design thinking. It's kind of almost the opposite of the scientific method. So in scientific method, the scientists come up with a hypothesis, they test it, and then they either reject the hypothesis or they keep it and they publish it. So design thinking is the opposite. We started with no preconceived notions. We went out, we talked about 43 different people, everything from patients and families to physicians to allied health. And then we also did a deep dive and looked at every pain point of the last 1,500 patients who've had brain tumor surgery. And between those two things, we were able to then design prototypes that reflected those needs, and then launched it like a company, where we launched with all of our new, we have a navigator. She has an email address. We have a website. We have standardized referrals. We have patient education. Again, all reflecting the need of that empathize stage. And then went out and tried it. And it you know, surprisingly, I guess, you know, surprisingly or not, depending on how you look at it, but it's worked really, really well. So for things like time to getting MRI or time to getting radiation, we went from, you know, really pretty low to now almost best in class in a lot of those values. So it's just been very effective.
What are some of the specific changes? I was wondering if you could give us a specific example of a problem that you identified through that consultation process and then how you solved it.
Sure. So I'll give you two very concrete examples. So one thing we noticed is there was a disparity in the outcomes for patients from rural towns, so less than 50,000, versus urban. So if you come from a town of less than 50,000 people, you end up having much lower quality indicator metrics than if you were from a larger town. And interestingly, it's not a matter of being from far away. So someone from a town of 50,000 that's close to Kingston will do worse than someone from, let's say, Peterborough, which is quite a bit further away, but a larger town. And when we looked into, you know, we identified that through the quantitative methods. Then we went and we actually spoke to people from the two different patient demographics and tried to see, you know, what are the differences here? And that, again, gives that very person, that human-centric perspective to quantitative data. And we found a big thing is that people didn't really know once they were discharged from surgery when they should hear from radiation, when they should get the MRI. They didn't really know what was supposed to happen next. And so they weren't able to flag when they were falling between the cracks. And it seemed like people from smaller towns were less likely to advocate for themselves and to come forward and say, hey, why haven't I heard anything, than people from larger towns. And so one way we got around that is we made these patient educational materials, these brochures, walking patients through, okay, here are all the people you're going to meet. This is what you should expect. This is the likely treatment you're going to get, so they can know what's coming. And importantly, in that brochure, we created a timeline where they knew after surgery, this is when you should be hearing from each person. And here are the contact informations if you don't hear from them. So it was a way of empowering the patient to understand what they should, to take away the mystery and honestly, the fear of not knowing what's coming next, and putting the power back in their hands so that they know if they haven't heard, they shouldn't have heard. Versus they haven't heard because something has gone wrong, which happens all the time in our system. Another example was that patients would get exceptional care while in hospital. That was a theme that came out in the thematic analysis of all the interviews. They were very happy with the care they received while in hospital. But then once they left hospital, it was as if they were completely on their own and they had no idea what to do. And it's extremely hard to get in contact with your neurosurgeon once you've left the hospital, right? So what we did with the navigator, we created a navigator not only as a unified touch point throughout all the different points of their journey, but we have an email address associated with her as well. And so when someone leaves, if they have a question, something they forgot to ask before leaving, now they can just email the navigator. Whereas before, they really had no effective way of getting answers to those questions other than waiting for the next visit. And what I found surprisingly is that the navigator email is absolutely used, but probably the most impactful part of it is the fact that people have the security of knowing that there is that email address if they need it, and most people don't use it. So those are two examples of just, you know, a combination of quantitative and qualitative insight that resulted in meaningful change for the patient, both in terms of their flow of care, but also the quality of care that they're getting.
Rewinding a bit, what was the timeline there? Did this work start right when you got to Queens 3 years ago, or has this been a shorter process? When did this all start?
It's a great question. It's really new. So it's only been 1 year. So the change happened over 1 year, which is just crazy for healthcare or academia. Nothing happens in 1 year. So 1 year is a long time in a startup's life, right? Mm-hmm. It's make or break. But in academia and healthcare, 1 year is no one expects anything to change in 1 year, really. So we launched it back in January of 2024. And then it's a bit of a soft launch. And then our navigator came on board in August of 24. And that's when we sort of really started formalizing things. So really, it's only been a little over a year. And already we're seeing these sort of outcomes. So, I'm glad the experiment worked.
Since its launch, the Integrative Brain Tumor Program has dramatically improved key metrics in brain tumor care. Notably, the number of patients receiving surgery within provincial targets has increased by over 40%. Delays in radiation therapy have been reduced by 40%, and postoperative MRIs are now performed in a more timely manner for 89% of patients. Brain tumor surgery volumes have surged as more patients are receiving care at KHSC, increasing from 46 patients with primary brain tumors in 2023-24 to a projected 105 patients in 2024-25. Despite its success, getting the program off the ground wasn't without its challenges. What have been some of the biggest challenges you faced while implementing the program?
It's so hard to do truly interdisciplinary work. It's really hard. And a lot of my work has been truly combining different fields because I think it's the best way to get to the most efficient and effective solution. So it works because it makes sense, but it only really makes sense to you in the beginning, right? So if you look at the academic structure, it's really meant to recognize and support things that it's familiar with, right? And so if you think of convincing people to come on board, getting grant funding, executing, getting even institutional support, if you're someone who has always done a good amount of science, it's resulted in predictable outcomes, and you're suggesting you want to do something very similar again, people feel comfortable by that. They recognize that because it's just the same thing, right? And so because you've been successful before, then you'll likely be successful again. They also understand your methods because they're well-established methods. They understand what you're trying to do because it's what other people tried to do before. And so getting institutional support, getting funding, getting even REB approval, things like this, there's a pipeline for it. When you do something that is truly unexpected and developing an academic neuro-oncology program as if it was a startup is truly unexpected. There's no pipeline for you. And it's very, very uncomfortable for people because they don't have a way of assessing whether or not you're going to be successful other than trusting your vision. And it's, you know, there's very limited funding for academia. There's very limited funding in the healthcare system to convince people that it's worth taking that funding. And instead of giving it to someone who is more of a sure bet, risking it on you is unbelievably hard. So getting buy-in on every level was very hard. And, it took a lot. The reason it only launched in January versus, year one was because it basically took 2 years of unrelenting advocacy to even give it a shot. And now that it's worked, there's a lot more enthusiasm around it. So it's a lot easier going forward. And we're probably going to go to several other institutions, both, in different countries and within the province in 2025, 26. So now that it's worked, you've overcome that barrier, but oh my gosh, the execution inertia and energy required to do something truly different is unbelievable. And it takes a lot of, you have to have a lot of perseverance. But we got there. And I think the moment that the hospital agreed to give us to fund the Navigator, that was really the turning point where after that, I knew we were going to be successful because it all hinged on that. And we have the absolutely most amazing, wonderful, smart human, a navigator named Dana. And she's just been so transformative to the program that when I met her and I knew we were going to partner, I knew it was going to be huge. And one more other shout out I want to give to is Dr. Katie Goldie. She's with the School of Nursing. She's a professor in the School of Nursing. The nursing perspective here was absolutely critical. So in the early days of the design process, she really provided this valuable nursing perspective, but also she's just an unbelievably intelligent person. So gave her overall insight to the program as well. So it was a battle I fought alongside other people. And I'm just very appreciative that they put their faith in me when really I had no data to support the vision.
With the foundation laid, the program is now poised for thoughtful expansion, according to Dr. Persner. What's next? Where do you see this program going in the near future and beyond?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a question that we can better address now that we have the Canadian Cancer Society funding. That was the second point where I realized that the viability of the project was real. So we're going to expand. I think it's really important to expand thoughtfully and not to blow up too big too quickly. It's another way that startups actually end up kind of shooting themselves in the foot is they get too big too quickly and they can't sustain themselves. So it's important to be very thoughtful. That was the reason why we initially did the program looking at just primary brain tumors because it's a very manageable population. The next step will first be to expand the diseases. So we're now looking at brain metastasis. Patients in our catchment with brain metastasis have many of the same problems as primary brain tumors, and we haven't addressed that at all at this point. It's only been primary brain tumors. So expanding to other diseases, starting with brain metastasis, and then expanding to different sites. So we're talking very actively with Health Sciences North, so the group in Sudbury, and then we're discussing with a group in Australia. And we're just working out the logistics now of, you know, what does that look like? And it can be anything from just adopting our materials and our pipeline and our live tracker, or it could be as complicated as going through the whole design thinking process themselves and then comparing, you know, the differences and similarities. And of course, I would help really mentor them through that process. But that's our next battle.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, folks. This is Abias from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Today, in this segment, we are joined by Dr. Charlotte Gibson, Assistant Professor and Associate Head of Mining Engineering at Queen's University. With experience across mining industry and research focused on critical minerals, sustainable processing, and machine learning in mining, she brings a unique perspective on the future of resource extraction. We will be talking about her journey from industry to academia and also about her research. Hello, Dr. Gibson. Welcome to Campus Corner. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you for asking. Can you give our audience a quick introduction about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I am an assistant professor and the associate head of the mining department at Queen's University. And in addition to teaching in mining in the area of mineral processing, I have a relatively large research group conducting different sort of lab-based and data-based research in the area of critical minerals processing.
Wow. So let's start from the very beginning. Dr. Gibson, what sparked your interest in mining engineering and critical mineral processing? Was there a moment or experience that led you down this path?
That's a really good question. I think like a lot of high school students today, when I was in high school and choosing what to study in university, I had really no idea about the mining industry or about critical minerals. I actually did my undergraduate degree here at Queen's. So I came to Queen's in the general first year engineering program. And through that, we had a course on geology, which I really enjoyed. And we also had courses in chemistry. And so I found this sort of niche program within mining engineering called mineral processing. And that sort of satisfied both of my interests in both rocks and minerals, as well as chemistry and chemical engineering.
It sounds cool as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I really sort of fell into it, but never really looked back.
Wow, that's such an interesting journey. I want to talk to you about your research, but let's zoom out for a moment because not everyone listening may be familiar with the term. Can you explain or break down what exactly critical minerals are and why have they become such a hot topic in recent years?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And I think the first important thing to note about critical minerals is that most of these critical minerals aren't actually minerals at all. They're elements, so elements from the periodic table. A lot of them are metals, but not all of them are metals. And in Canada, the list of critical minerals is a list. So this is a list of 34 different elements, if you will. And these, in order for an element to be deemed critical, according to the Canadian standard, it has to meet two criteria. The first is that it has to have its supply chain threatened. The second is that it has to have reasonable chance or prospect of actually being produced in Canada. So it has to be something that has some sort of risk in its production and something that we actually have here in Canada. In addition to those two criteria, it also has to meet one of the following. So it has to either be essential to Canada's economic or national security, or it needs to be required for our transition to a low carbon economy or a digital economy.
Yeah.
Or it needs to position Canada as a sustainable and strategic partner within global supply chains. So it's a bit of a complex definition, but basically these are elements on the periodic table that we have natural resources of in Canada that we have some sort of risk in the production, or we need them. They're integral to either our economy, to national security, to our energy transition, or it positions us well within our global supply chain, so with international sort of trading partners.
Wonderful. Your lab is at the forefront of research in this space. So can you tell our audience what is your current research focused on and what problems are you trying to solve?
Yeah, so my research is related to a lot of the upstream processing of these critical minerals. So it's not actually the mining of the minerals, so digging it out of the ground, but the stage that happens after that.
Okay.
So once we mine material, the first step is to physically separate the valuable minerals that contain those critical elements from the material that contains waste or is of no value to us. So these are physical separation processes, but they happen at extremely large scales. So some of these plants will be processing 100,000 or 200,000 tons per day of Wow. rock in order to concentrate those minerals. So within that space, my research is focused on one particular separation process called flotation. And flotation is a highly complex physical separation process where we are taking advantage of differences in mineral hydrophobicity, so their tendency to repel water, in order to actually float them on air bubbles to separate them from minerals that have no value to us. So all of my research falls sort of largely into the category of flotation. And within that, I have a lot of focus on copper, nickel, and lithium minerals.
Wonderful. So since you mentioned lithium, what are the biggest challenges in lithium mineral flotation, and how is your research addressing them?
Yeah, that's a good one. So in lithium flotation, lithium is a really interesting industry because before interest in lithium ion batteries, the lithium market was actually quite small. And what we've seen is that demand for lithium, because of uptake of electric vehicles and the need for sort of battery storage of electricity, the demand for lithium has gone up. And so we are now trying to open and operate new lithium mines all around the world in order to supply this demand. And because of that, a lot of the development of some of these lithium plants has been very fast. And so there's a lot of parts of the process and phenomena that are observed during the process that we don't actually understand fully what's going on. And when we don't understand fundamentally how a process works, when something goes wrong, it becomes very hard to troubleshoot it. So a lot of the work that I do in lithium mineral flotation is related to trying to actually understand something that's happening in an industrial process that we don't know why it happens. We just know that it does happen and here's how we fix it, but we don't know why the fix solves the problem. So it's a very interesting space to be in and a very challenging one.
Wow, that actually sounds very complex. Looking at the next generation students and young professionals, how is Queen's University preparing them for careers in the critical mineral sector?
Yeah, that's a great question. So within Queen's, one of the first and the most important aspects of critical minerals production that we instill and develop in our undergraduate students, starting in first year, and we do this all the way through till they graduate, is environmental and social stewardship. So understanding that the mining industry is obviously a very sensitive one, and it needs to be done responsibly. So this is a very important part of the Queen's mining curriculum. In addition to that, we're teaching a lot of very important technical skills at a very high level. So I believe we are the largest mining school in Canada. And I would, obviously I'm biased, but I think that we are the best mining school in Canada. And so with that comes very, very strong technical skills in our students. And to develop those technical skills and allow our students to sort of apply and see those skills in the real world, we have a few unique features of our program. So one of them is that we take our students on field trips. So all of our second year students, once they're in the mining engineering program, we take them to Northern Ontario and actually take them to an underground mine. So they get to go underground and see what that is like. We take them through processing facilities. And we also have them use virtual reality tools in their undergraduate education to give them exposure and some interactive experiences in those remote and hazardous environments that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get through just sort of sitting in a classroom. So through both of these sort of experiential learning opportunities, we're really helping to develop those technical skills.
Amazing. That brings us to the end of this segment. We have touched on Dr. Charlotte Gibson's journey into mining engineering and importance of critical minerals in today's world and here at Queen, but there is still so much more to explore. So Dr. Gibson will be joining us again next Monday to continue this conversation. And that's a wrap, folks. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment Campus Corner. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, April 16th, a little cooler, 5 degrees with a mix of rain and flurries in the forecast, dropping down to minus 2 overnight. Thursday, April 17th, we're back to the beautiful weather, daytime high of 9 degrees, and it will be sunny, dropping down to 1 overnight. Friday, April 18th, still staying steady at 9 degrees, but a 60% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 4 overnight. Saturday, April 19th, another double-digit day with a 30% chance of precipitation, but it is going to be warm and quite nice otherwise. Sunday, April 20th, sunny with a daytime high of 9. And Monday, one of the nicest days of the year thus far. It's going to be 13 with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reduced load restrictions are still in effect in Kingston. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the traffic bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, 500 to 472 is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Queen Street, Ontario to King Street East is closed for the dismantling and removal of the tower crane at 18 Queen Street, weather permitting. Berry Street, Queen Street to Colborne is closed for demobilization of equipment at the 283 Queen Street site. And Main Street, Anne to Ellis, is closed to facilitate the installation of a new gas service by Utilities Kingston. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road, Centennial, and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street to Union Street and Johnson Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Hello everyone, my name is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're going through this week's concerts and events calendars. On Wednesday, Whiskey Smoke will be playing a gig at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Hotel Wolf Island will also be running its usual open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Also on Wednesday, the Kingston Grand, as part of their Grand On Stage series, will have performers of the Classic Albums Live Concert Series playing the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours. This performance starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets available on the Grand's website for around between $44 and $55. Frank Ryan is also scheduled to play Wednesday night between 8 and 11 at Musiki. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at The Buckle from 8 to 11 p.m. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is scheduled to perform at the Isabel Bader at 7:30 Thursday evening. Tickets for said performance are available for between $15 and $35 on the Isabel's website. Also on Thursday, three bands, B.A. Johnston, Owl Farm, and The Strange Happenings will be playing at The Mansion. Tickets for the show, starting at 9 p.m., are available for around $10 on Ticketscene or for $15 at the door. The Toucan also has some live performers lined up for Thursday night, with Sarah Jane Riley and Dylan Ireland performing from 9:10 to 1 as part of their Rules for the Collective Good tour. After that, on Friday, band Cheyenne Twink will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory. The show, starting at 7:30, has tickets available on Ticketscene for around $25. Also on Friday, the blues-slash-rock group Hellhound Trail will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. On Saturday, Frank Ryan is on to play a set or two at Tiernanog from 7 to 9. The Boo Radley Project will also be returning to the Toucan Saturday night for a show running from 10:30 to 2. Also Saturday night, the Marion Drexler Band will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8. On Sunday, Neil Carter will be performing a collection of classics at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5. And later on, Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki from 4:30 to 6:30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendars. On Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. Also on Wednesday, One Eye Jacks will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7, and both Something in the Water and Daft Ruin will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Daft will host Queerioki from 8 to 11. Folks can also head to the Kingston Public Market, which is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. The Kingston Spring Night Market will also be running at Memorial Center from 4 to 8 p.m. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group will be hosting its usual public run this Thursday, starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, The Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD students will be giving a free talk in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. Folks can also head down to participate in Runner's Choice East End Run Group at 7:50 a.m. at the Canets Kingston Supermart, 29 Niagara Park. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Do you have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concerts and events calendars? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. I have been Henry, CFRC intern for the Queen's Department of History, and this has been my last broadcast of the concert and events calendars updates. Someone else will be taking over soon. I hope everyone listening has a nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Today on Wings, we delve into the arcane subculture of internet trolls, courtesy of Aoife Cook of Australia's national community radio program, Women on the Line.
when I started seeing what we all now know when we say things like don't feed the trolls or don't read the comments, I kind of had this impulse where I really had to read the comments, you know, and I was really fascinated by the very irrational, extreme forms of rage that were there in the comment sections, often under the most mundane of topics. But of course, when the topic got onto something like feminism, it was 1,000 times worse. So I really wanted to get a sense of why exactly are people so angry here? And then after a while, why are they all using similar kinds of slang, similar kinds of language? And of course, it's because a lot of them were on the same kinds of forums.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello and welcome to Women on the Line. I'm Aoife Cook, and this week's guest is Angela Nagel. Angela is a researcher, an academic currently based at the University of Limerick in Ireland. She's a fellow countrywoman, and she's speaking today on her area of expertise, which is anti-feminist internet subcultures. Angela, can you describe maybe quite broadly the landscape of, I'm going to say, online misogyny, and maybe tell us about a few of the prominent forums that are out there?
It's kind of jokingly referred to as the manosphere, which is the broader group of, you know, anti-feminists, so-called men's rights activists, forums. There's a whole huge constellation of sites broadly called the alt-right, the alternative right. Then within that, you have the nominally men's rights groups and all the various anti-feminist groups. When you hear somebody being called an MRA or a men's rights activist online, it's very unlikely they actually have any men's rights activist credentials, that they've been involved in, for example, like fathers' rights. You know, it tends to be a little bit juvenile and more about culture than politics, really. So you have something like the Red Pill, for example. The Red Pill is a reference to the Matrix. So it's all about kind of trying to see the world as it really is and not be like foolish men who go sleepwalking into marriages with untrustworthy women and this kind of thing. And then 4chan is very important. I mean, its heyday was quite a few years ago. Certainly 4chan B, which is a forum with the random board within 4chan. But it's hugely influential on internet culture more broadly. People probably all seen, for example, lolcats, which years ago was a little meme with a cat in the middle and it had text at the top and bottom. All the memes that we use now kind of imitate that style. And that came from 4chan. Hacker group Anonymous came from 4chan. But also it is, for example, a place where DDoS attacks on feminist websites have been organized. That's distributed denial of service. It just means that a large group of people go and bombard a website until it shuts down. Just, so the kind of pranking culture of 4chan has often been used against kind of feminist groups.
Hey, Elliot Roger here. I'm up in the hills in Montecito right now. It's truly a beautiful day. But as I've always said, a beautiful environment is the darkest hell if you have to experience it all alone. And sadly, I've been alone for a very long time.
Okay, Elliot Roger was somebody who recorded a lot of videos of himself and wrote a kind of manifesto. And he spoke about my war on women. And Elliot Roger went on to plot kind of a massacre, really, of a sorority house. And he said that he wanted his revenge on women for ignoring him and rejecting him sexually. Now, on the day, he couldn't get in to the sorority house, so he ended up shooting people on the street and was chased down by police until he eventually shot himself. And Elliot Roger is referred to online sometimes as the supreme gentleman, because he spoke about himself in that way. So Elliot Roger became a person that was really hotly debated. For example, Laurie Penny and many others wrote opinion pieces about it at the time, you know, about his kind of war on women and his sense of entitlement that he deserved to get this kind of attention from women. And then also, of course, he became talked about a lot on men's rights forums, on the Red Pill, on 4chan. And really, he just became a way in which people ended up having these very important conversations about that sense of entitlement that does tend to pervade these extreme or militantly anti-feminist kind of forums. There's also, for example, a group called Men Going Their Own Way, which they pronounce MGTOW, which is a separatist kind of culture. It's literally about men deciding no longer to have any interaction with women at all, if possible.
Hi, everyone. I thought I'd take some time to share a message to all the women listening to me speak, as well as the women that have yet to hear me out. I'm sure by now, as women, you see men going your own way as a growing threat to your attempts to use men to do your bidding. Men are waking up to our slavery and leaving the plantation that you call marriage. We recognize that our biology compels us to provide and protect for you in return for the opportunity to have kids with you. But now you use the feminist courts to take this away from us. And so many of us are leaving and never coming back. In your increasing attempts to take more and more power away from men, you are all now feminists, every single last one of you. But ironically, it's feminism that will lead to your undoing and eventual downfall. It wasn't enough for you to enslave men by having us labor and toil in the workplace, building roads, building buildings, and all the other materials that you find around you. Instead, you thought that you could be sneaky and convince us to vacuum, wash the dishes, take care of children, in addition to farming the land and building the man-made world.
Angela, have you any sense of the numbers involved?
It is extremely difficult because a lot of cases, what you're looking at are forums like 4chan, which are completely anonymous. I mean, every user just is called anonymous. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the influence of 4chan is much greater than the number of people who actually go on there every evening. And then there's all the other sites, too. I mean, I would say it is relatively small groups of obsessives on things like men going their own way. I mean, for example, if you look it up on YouTube, there's a number of YouTube channels, but it is the same guys, you know, repeatedly making videos, giving advice to other guys who want to go their own way. So it is hard to make up the numbers. But for example, some of you might have seen Milo Yiannopoulos's campus tour that's been going on in recent months. Milo Yiannopoulos is a writer at Breitbart, which is a conservative American magazine. Mm. And Milo Yiannopoulos has been going around college campuses, really challenging feminism, essentially, but I suppose intersectional feminism or Black Lives Matter and all kinds of things. So he goes there and he kind of offends everyone, and the whole crowd gets whipped up into a massive row. And, you know, feminists usually protest. But then a really loud booming sound of guys shouting Trump, Trump, Trump starts.
Donald Trump.
Oh.
And
that's really interesting because I think this is the kind of moment where all of the stuff I've been looking at for years, which is weird and small and subcultural, and people think, oh, it's just a few weird people on the internet, has sort of started leaking into the mainstream in a big way. Because there's a direct line now between Donald Trump and these what would have been considered small, insignificant internet forums, you know, and Milo Yiannopoulos is kind of the link, I would say, in a way. He makes references to these things. When people ask questions from the audience, they know what the alt-right is. They know 4chan. They know all this kind of stuff. And the kind of stuff that I'm looking at is really his bread and butter. Mm. But he's a Trump supporter, you know, and they all seem to be.
I mean, would you have a sense of whether the people involved share many characteristics in terms of who these people are?
Well, what I'm really interested in is the fact that so much of it has sprung from a very geeky kind of culture.
Yeah.
Like in the past, we might have associated anti-feminist or sort of militant anti-feminist cultural politics with kind of jocks and macho kind of culture and stuff like that. So I think it's really interesting that the space that has really defined this whole culture that I'm talking about is very geeky and actually very kind of gender fluid, if you like, in the sense that 4chan doesn't have the kind of conservative anti-feminist politics of the past, which were typically about the family, anti-abortion and so on. 4chan has very libertine kind of nihilistic politics, and it's gender fluid in the sense that it can take in things like My Little Male, My Little Pony fans, and there's loads of gay and bisexual porn on there. There's loads of discussion of same-sex attraction among men. They also call, like, refer to each other as beta males, or you know, they refer to men who are not dominant as beta males.
On Wings, you're hearing from Angela Nagel, an academic researcher based at the University of Limerick in Ireland. Her area of expertise is anti-feminist internet subcultures. The interviewer is Aoife Cook.
You describe this idea of the beta uprising in detail. Can you explain what the term means and really what's going on?
Well, as with all things on 4chan, there's a tone that is used that is a kind of a joking, ironic tone. But the problem, I would say, is that they also mean it. And that was one of the things that I wanted to talk about. So when you try to talk about something that is going on 4chan, they always say, oh, you don't get it, it's a joke. But what I was writing about was situations where the so-called jokes on 4chan actually turned into, you know, real-life killings, real-life violence. So I talked about Elliot Rodger, who I mentioned earlier, and another killer called Harper Mercer, who also, it's believed that he had actually posted on 4chan just warning that he was going to do the shooting before the shooting happened. There's not absolute confirmation of that. But then after that, on 4chanb, after these shootings happened, they described them as like the beta rebellion or the beta uprising on 4chan. And they were really celebrating these shootings as a great thing because they were beta males kind of fighting back. And it's beta males fighting back against the women who are not sexually available to them, the women who reject them, then also, I guess, the jocks and the kind of popular kids. So I thought that was interesting in that they were actually recognizing quite proudly the link between real violence, typically against women, and these kind of forums. If you draw the connection, people say, oh, you're being puritanical, you're, you know, overreaching kind of. But they're quite happy to do it themselves, actually. They're quite proud to be associated with these kind of mass shootings.
So can you tell us what the term beta is and the beta uprising?
They mean a man who is not masculine, who is kind of small, not physically imposing, that kind of thing. So not macho, not masculine.
And the contrast also, to an alpha, of course, the alpha,
yeah,
the
exactly.
Idea of the alpha
yeah.
male.
And this feeds into also, they have a very kind of a social Darwinist view of the world. Mm. So they're big into the idea that women have a kind of evolutionary drive to be attracted to violent macho guys, and this explains why they're not getting laid. rather than in many cases, you know, I loved the Nice Guys of OkCupid Tumblr that was around there years ago. I'm sure it still is, which was all about this phenomenon where these kind of beta males have all of these kind of elaborate Darwinian theories to explain their lack of success with women. But it never dawns on them that the fact that they absolutely hate and loathe women might be a part of the problem.
Maybe. Yeah.
Listen, you ladies are just a bunch of wannabe men. You wish you could live up to the strength and capacities of masculinity, but you can't. You're just wannabe men. Even down to our muscles, down to our functional strength, down to the way the functional equipment between our legs, down to taking a piss. We have this penis that we can just whoop out in pee standing up, but you little ladies have to sit down and tinkle like little princesses. You have to sit down so you can tinkle like little princesses, okay?
And how does that fit then with, you know, what you've seen as also kind of a acceptance maybe of queerness or some kind of new ideas around gender? How does that fit together, or is it just confusing and it doesn't make any sense?
I'm still kind of figuring it out. I mean, maybe some of this wouldn't be shocking to somebody who's 19, you know what I mean, who has grown up maybe in a culture where ideas of gender fluidity are very influential. And maybe it is partly an age thing or something like that, because I do find when I talk to people about this, younger people seem less baffled by the seeming contradiction of the very extreme misogyny and militant anti-feminism and kind of mixing with this very gender fluid politics. But in the past, we would have always thought, and certainly, you know, academic writers, for example, who theorized masculinity, tended to think that gender fluidity among men was a kind of antidote to traditional macho ideas about maleness, that, for example, were all about kind of you prove your masculinity through not showing your feelings and even violence and war and things like that. And so we kind of always thought, or certainly those who theorize masculinity tended to think, that if men were becoming less traditionally masculine, that this was a step forward, or that this was necessarily progressive. And so it's interesting to see now that in a kind of moment where gender fluidity is talked about a great deal and is kind of celebrated in very mainstream platforms, even like Facebook, for example, in some countries offering a lot of different gender identity options, it's interesting that the really militant anti-feminism online is actually coming from these very gender fluid kind of cultures.
I mean, it sounds like your central argument and contribution to the feminist analysis or understanding of these issues is that the world of beta males is almost a new strain of misogyny, if that's fair enough. And this seems to be a challenge to some prominent feminist thinkers who regard this online world as the same old, using different technology. Would that be fair to say that you've come up against other feminist thinkers with this?
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, when I was writing the PhD, I looked for feminist writing on misogyny online, and I can't think of an exception. All of it was saying, all of it started off with a kind of a cyber-utopian perspective. So the idea would be that the internet is an inherently democratic, non-hierarchical space, you know, that flattens hierarchies and it gives everyone a voice and so on. So all very kind of cyber utopian stuff. And because they start out from that perspective, they say, well, yes, there's misogyny online, and this is a problem because it's old fashioned ideas anachronistically showing up on what should be this really utopian, brilliant space. And I think that's kind of what got me interested in this whole thing to begin with, because I was seeing that analysis, and then I was seeing, no, actually, what's happening here is something different. It's something new. I mean, there's no comparison between a guy who goes on 4chan to share really hardcore and very gender fluid kind of pornography and, you know, like Peter Hitchens or some conservative who thinks we should return to the nuclear family and, you know, have good manners and, you know, go to mass every weekend. You know what I mean? So to me, I was thinking these just aren't the same thing.
Yeah.
There's something profoundly different about them. So just as an example, with the academic names, I would struggle to think of them off the top of my head. But for example, Laurie Penny, who's quite a major kind of a columnist and public commentator you know, sort of big on Twitter. She has said, she wrote a book called Cybersexism. It was an ebook for Bloomsbury. And she kind of repeated that idea quite a bit, actually. And I could see that she wasn't really able to square these things, because to me it seemed like, on the one hand, she was recognizing that this misogyny isn't coming from the same old sources. It's coming from really weird, geeky subcultures. But then on the other hand, when it came to theorizing it, she was saying, oh, this is just the old traditional kind of ideas about gender breaking through. And every time one of these shootings, for example, happens that is linked to these kind of online cultures, you'll find an article or several even in mainstream publications saying masculinity is the problem, this is an expression of masculinity, and they don't realize that the spaces that they're talking about actually are kind of anti-alpha male in lots of ways. They're very hostile to, you know, jocks and any kind of traditional ideas about masculinity in a lot of cases.
Where do you think lies the most useful challenge
It's a very hard one to say. I'm a little bit worried about the censorship angle. I kind of, when I started the PhD, I would have been much more sympathetic to it. As in, although I wouldn't have approved of state censorship, I would have argued for example, private companies, social media companies, will say, doing more to stop this kind of stuff from happening. Now I'm a bit more skeptical of that, because I think it's extremely difficult to actually regulate these things. Mm. And often what happens is, in the process, you end up making the case for types of regulation that are actually going to be used much better by Erdogan and Turkey, or, you know, whoever it might be. I would be wary of making any kind of case for kind of a censorship angle online. I wouldn't, actually. I would oppose it, in fact.
Back then, I didn't know the dress code of a feminist. I mean, there are some that, you know, that go through the cracks, and, you know, you probably can't tell by the way they dress, walk, talk, etc. I mean, even body language is very important as well. But when you start to, you know, peep the game and realize how all of this works, you will see.
What role do you think these forums are playing in the lives of these guys? And, you know, are they all young men and it's a hobby, or is it a place to let off steam? Or, you know, is the role of it that it is a much deeper and more dangerous breeding ground for misogynistic ideologies amongst kind of a minority, more hardcore group?
I'd say it's the latter. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people who just go and browse these things and kind of, you know, dip into them. But there are also plenty of guys who on there who are, you know, absolutely obsessed. And, you know, I think the fact that it's kind of a bit of an American phenomenon is important too, because in the kind of dating world, there is a concentration of sexual opportunity among men that is greater than it is among women, right? So in other words, based on what people say in surveys and so on, there are a smaller group of men having more sex, right? And there are, whereas with women, the number is more average.
Yeah.
As in, the number of people that a woman has slept with is more average, whereas with men, it's more concentrated among a small group of men. And I can't help but think that is an influence on things as well. Why is that concentration greater in America than it is elsewhere? I think that's a question worth looking into. And it does strike me, I mean, America, I think, does. I mean, I was actually born in America and I was there as a child. America does have a much more competitive kind of social culture. I mean, I don't wish to kind of make excuses for these guys, but they're trying and with great frustration to make sense of a world in which there's a kind of a real sexual hierarchy that they're experiencing, and unfortunately for them, they're more or less at the bottom with. It's not, you know, something that their egos can really take in, and so they try to come up with all these kind of, you know, discredited Darwinian, social Darwinian rather, theories about why this might be.
So we're not saying, I assume, that the lack of sex is leading to this level of misogyny.
No, but I think it's the backdrop. It's the kind of social context that you would have to take into account. You know, and the high school shootings, I mean, obviously the availability of guns is the main thing there, but there's something else there as well. I mean, I do think there is a really intensely competitive environment in kind of American culture. The kind of free marketeers are always celebrated. But I think it does have these ugly manifestations too, where when people find themselves not only at the bottom of the hierarchy, but just not even in the game, kind of not even, you know, able to assert themselves in any way economically, you know, sexually, socially, and they find themselves in this deeply competitive culture, and they find it dehumanizing. But the problem is, they could express that in all kinds of ways. They could be more critical of the hyper-competitive kind of free market ideology. They could be more critical of you know, they could argue for, you know, a kinder society or a better society or a less competitive, brutal kind of society. But instead, this is kind of the form that it takes. Mm. So it's not that I'm saying, you know, that I'm giving a reason or an excuse maybe for why they're doing it. But I'm just saying I can see that there are things that actually we should be critical of, you know, that they're in some way taking in, but it's coming out the other side as this really, really hideous ideology. I mean, I actually think when it comes to the internet, I think whoever is making the best memes tends to be winning. I know that's not a very edifying kind of thought, but for example, there was a time there for a little while where the kind of memes that feminists were producing about these guys were absolutely hilarious. So, for example, the nice guys of OkCupid thing was absolutely ingenious. It was so insightful about a personality type that women who were using, you know, dating sites were seeing all the time, you know, and it was better than a million academic essays at actually pointing out the contradiction to these guys, you know. Just in case anyone hasn't seen it, nice guys, well, OkCupid would pick out guys who had a profile on there who were saying, you know, I'm a really nice guy, you know, that's why I don't get all the